Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today on Behind the Knife, we have Dr. Ali Saleem, who's the chief of the Division of Trauma, Burns, and Surgical Critical Care at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's also a professor of Harvard Medical School. And we also have guest moderator, Dr. Matthew Martin, back to join us on Behind the Knife. And today we discuss racial disparities in organ donation, part of Dr. Saleem's plethora of research. And we also dive into penetrating abdominal trauma, and Dr. Saleem walks us through step-by-step how he deals with this very important issue. But first, our opening shot.
Okay, welcome to our opening shot. And this week, we're talking to Dr. Ali Saleem. And because of that, we are going to cover a trauma-related topic for the American Board of Surgery and Training exam that's coming up at the end of the month. Glasgow Coma Scale is always on there. And I always have to brush up on it before the exam to make sure I don't screw it up. And so, John, how do you start off with the Glasgow Coma Scale?
Yeah, so the first thing I look at is the motor. I just always go for that one first because that's a way of me remembering that it is the most important part of the Glasgow Coma Scale. So that is a 1 through 6 grading scale. 6 means the patient is following commands. 5, the patient is localizing pain or they're moving their hand to that certain spot. 4 is that the patient is withdrawing from the pain. So they tries to back away from where you're forcing the pain. Number 3 is that there's flexion with pain, is a decorticate. Number 2 is extension with pain, a decerebrate. And number 1 is no response from any type of pain ring.
Yeah, and it's important to remember, I've seen questions on there where they'll ask you what is the most prognostic of their future neurologic outcome. And the answer for that is the motor. The verbal and the eye opening can be related to drugs or alcohol toxicity, and you won't be able to determine it at the time of presentation. But if they're decerebrate on presentation, that's a bad prognostic indicator. And the one thing, John, we were just reading, I always have a hard time with the 2 and 3 in the motor. And we found this one that describes it: if I apply pain, his body tightens towards his core, is a 3. Also known as the decorticate, or number 2, if I apply pain, his body flexes away from his core or extension, and this is the decerebrate. So if they're flexing away, that's the 2. If their arms are coming in towards them with pain, that's the decorticate, that's the 3. So
okay. Thanks, Kevin. The next one I'll always look at is verbal, which is 5 points. And the max points you for 5 is that when the patient is completely oriented and he's talking normally. 4 points get you he's talking, but he's confused. Number 3 is that he is saying words, but they don't make sense. And number 2, he's just making sounds. And number 1, when he gets 1 point, is no response whatsoever. So maximum of 5 points in the verbal.
Great. And I'll close it out here with the eye opening. And the one way I remember how many points each system gets is I start with my eyes, that's 4, my mouth is verbal, so that's 5, and then I think of my body as the motor and 6, so I just kind of go down 4, 5, 6. So if his eyes are opening normally, then that's a 4. If I call his name and he opens his eyes, that's a 3. If he opens his eyes to pain, that's a 2. And then if you can't get the patient to open their eyes no matter what you do, they get a 1.
Yeah, but then just a few other tidbits that in a lot of the absite review portions, with a patient comes in with a GCS score less than or equal to 14, they get a head CT. In some texts, they say that if you have a GCS of less than or equal to 10, then you should be intubated. Although, you know, the typical saying is GCS less than 8, you intubate. I don't think you're going to get a question between a 10 and an 8, so I wouldn't worry about that. And then also anything, a GCS of less than or equal to 8 would require an ICP monitor.
And that's because you wouldn't be able to follow their neuro exams. And John, just one last thing for some of the new listeners. What's the lowest GCS score a patient can have?
Yeah, see, this is a tricky one where the lowest GCS score you get is 3. So that's always something that they might try to throw out there to get you.
Good luck on the absite.
Okay, and now on to Dr. Ali Saleem.
So welcome everybody to another fantastic edition of Behind the Knife. We are absolutely pleased to have Dr. Ali Salim with us, who is the Chief of the Division of Trauma, Burns, and Surgical Critical Care at Brigham and Women's Hospital and is a professor at Harvard Medical School. Ali, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Well, thanks for having me.
We also have another guest, actually, moderator here today. We're absolutely pleased to have Dr. Matthew Martin, who's a trauma surgeon and also has been a past guest on Behind the Knife and also spent some time with Ali. Matt, welcome as a guest moderator on Behind the Knife.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here and looking forward to listening to what Ali has to say.
So, Ali, for those who don't understand or aren't aware of your background, give us a little bit about kind of where you came from, how came to the point where you're at Harvard, and tell us a little bit, most interesting, about what is your connection to Tanzania?
Oh, absolutely. So I actually grew up in New York, but my parents are actually from Tanzania. We moved to the United States when I was 2.5, and we lived in New York. My dad was ambassador to the UN at the time. So when he and my mom went back to Tanzania, I was about 10. My sister was 11.5. We stayed and just continued to go to school here. So basically, grown up here in the States since I was 2.5 years old. So after New York, I went to the international school for up until about 8th grade, then went to boarding school in Pennsylvania, and then from boarding school found my way in Durham, North Carolina as a Dukie. Go Devils. And then from Duke Medical School at Howard University in D.C., and then moved out to the West Coast and did my residency and fellowship at USC. Had a couple of jobs, including working at USC's faculty for a while, then Cedars-Sinai's program director for about 5 years, then came over to Boston and took over the job here 2 years ago.
So I have to ask you, what was it like being staff and actually maybe a fellow with the young Dr. Martin, who I did residency and was with for the last 17 years of my life?
Matt was great. He was definitely somebody who kept you on your toes, but also, you know, probably shouldn't believe anything he has to say either, ever.
Fantastic. That's good advice, sir. Well, Dr. Salim, this is John McClellan. We spoke briefly at the Academic Surgical Congress when Dr. Steele handed you the cell phone and told you to talk. But the one thing we wanted to get on the discussion with you today, sir, and is your research that focused on the care and outcomes of the trauma patients and improving the physiology of organ donors and improving the rate of donation, which is definitely unique to our podcast because we haven't had anybody talk about that before. And you certainly have had a lot of research in that area. And, you know, the first question, I guess, for all types of research we look into is, what is your motivation for doing that research in the first place?
Yeah, I think it's probably, you know, a couple of reasons. First, it started, I think Matt can attest to this, just in terms of the patients that we saw. You know, probably a lot of research that we start kind of starts with a patient that you had that you didn't quite understand, you know, what was going on, or a series of patients that you took care of. And for us there, you know, we had a lot of penetrating trauma. And this was towards the end of my residency, so we're talking late 90s, and during my fellowship in 2000, 2001, we had a lot of penetrating trauma and also a lot of penetrating head trauma. And what struck me, especially with the penetrating head trauma, was how profoundly sick that they can get. And you know, didn't quite understand, especially thinking that the only injury they had was an injury to the brain and why that would affect all the other organ systems. And I think that's sort of how it started with us, and just sort of trying to understand the pathophysiology of why these head-injured patients were so unstable. And then that sort of, you know, moved on towards the brain death and what that meant and how we as physicians could do a better job of taking care of them, just understanding the complications that were associated with brain death and understanding the pathophysiology, that kind of helped us anticipate some of these complications and helped us take better care of it. And some of the earlier research that I did was just looking at just interventions that we did in terms of how that would affect the physiology of these badly head injured patients.
Hey, so Ali, and that's a great point. Gene Moore, I think, said it best when he talked about how he started doing research, and he was told to go to M&M, see what our most common problems are that are being presented, and then start researching that. Yeah. So what were the big problems with organ donor and brain death or near brain death patient management that we were seeing back then and that we've made strides on?
So I think, you know, back then it was more of an understanding of what was happening. You know, a lot of times patients would come in, they'd be fine, you know, you're working them up, and then all of a sudden they get profoundly sick as they're herniating. And if you're not doing anything, they end up arresting. And, you know, at that time as a resident, you're actually fine because it was one less patient because we were so busy. But as you start understanding the ramifications of that, you know, I think organ donation is just sort of starting at that time. You know, it probably hadn't caught on nationally in terms of public education as it is right now. But as we were educated at the time that, you know, well, this was a potential patient that could have been an organ donor and, you know, the patient arrested, is there anything that we could have done to prevent that? And then as you start understanding that, you know, these were patients who were arresting because of just basic critical care that they weren't getting, and that just that intervention could actually help in terms of these patients becoming organ donors. And I think it was back then at SC, and I'd credit Dr. Dimitriadis, who sort of kind of pushed this as well for us to do a better job of taking care of these patients, because he was definitely an advocate for donation and said that, you know, this is something that we could do to at least help. The local OPO at that time was One Legacy, help in terms of donation, just by doing, you know, adequate critical care. And when I was a fellow, that was sort of our job as the critical care fellow. And I think if you remember, Matt, for you too, that we were sort of, it was our job to take care of these patients once they got to the ICU.
So Dr. Saleem, I've obviously read a lot of your research prior to having you here on the show. And during your research, what were the major barriers that you found that prevented organ donation, and what are the same factors that may be preventing this process today?
So I think, you know, there's a lot of different reasons of why there's such a discrepancy in terms of, you know, organ demand, organ supply. I mean, mostly there's just not enough organ donors. And, you know, I think, you know, what we could at least do is try to maximize what those available donors are in terms of brain dead or cadaveric donors. You know, there's two types of donors, the living donors, and then there's the cadaveric donors. The living donors, you know, for mostly kidneys, that's, you know, all these other interventions in terms of trying to increase that population. But for us, from a trauma perspective, from an IC perspective, we deal mostly with the cadaveric donors. So issues were there, like the ones we were talking about, just the medical issues, the medical failures, where, you know, if you don't anticipate the complex pathophysiology, if you don't intervene, if you don't treat these patients will arrest, and if they arrest, those are actually organs that you wouldn't be able to get for donation. So I think doing a better job of critical care, doing a better job of management is one thing that we've been able to do, you know, at least that's to address that barrier. Probably, you know, once you address that, I think another barrier, which is something that we all have to deal with, is the idea of consent. You know, now that you do have a donor, you know, you have to be able to get them consented, you know, family consent, so that they can actually go on to donate the organ. So there's a lot of barriers with respect to consent, and that's also where some of my research has been, especially when it looks at the disparities with donation and why certain ethnicities
would be less inclined to consent for donation.
So Ali, can you kind of quantify for us the scope of this problem? Are we close to meeting the organ demand? Are we not close? Are we getting worse? Are we getting better?
We've probably been stagnant for probably the last 10 years. And if you just look at the numbers, you know, right now we probably have about 120,000 people who are on the waiting list. And last year, almost 30,000 transplants that were performed from about 14,000 donors. So that 14,000 donors includes both living and cadaveric. And that number, 14,000, has probably been the same over the past probably almost 10 years, about that number. Whereas the number of people who are being added on the waiting list has been going up. Probably not as much as it has been in the past, but that number is going up. So that discrepancy between those transplants and people who are on the waiting list has unfortunately been getting a little wider. So, short answer is we probably haven't made a lot of progress in the past few years.
Now, Dr. Salim, I'm sure you've had a lot of these conversations with family. You know, what is the most important factors that you think about when you're walking into that room to talk to a patient's family about organ donation? And, you know, and how should this conversation go?
Actually, you know, to be honest, that conversation probably shouldn't be going on with us as the care practitioner. You know, I think our job as we're taking care of patients is basically taking care of the patient, period. And we leave that discussion for donation to someone else, and it's usually the local OPO. And in fact, that whole discussion probably should not be had by the physicians taking care of the patients. And if anything, when that discussion does occur, the likelihood for consenting actually goes down. So we talk about decoupling is basically decoupling the care management team versus that discussion that happens later, and you want to get the local OPO and their members who are trained to have that discussion to have that discussion. So typically what we would do is just as you're having that difficult discussion with the family, if they have no other questions, you may suggest that, well, if there's no other questions, you know, there is another group of people who would, or another organization or another set of people who just wanted to talk to you about some things, and then just leave it open-ended like that, where you have someone else have that discussion.
Yeah, it definitely seems like a team effort. It's good to have all those parts involved. Yeah.
So, Ali, what do you say to, I still talk to physicians who will say, you know, I have a good relationship with this family, and how can a stranger coming in, you know, have a better an open discussion with them than I could as the physician who's been with them, you know, through these hard times and have been managing their loved one?
Yeah, Matt, that's a great point. And, you know, so like, interestingly, I think they're starting to look at that, you know, because we are discouraged as physicians to have that discussion. But I think more and more there are times as you develop a relationship with the patients and the patient's family that it seems that having that discussion would be appropriate. I think the current recommendation is still not to have that discussion, because it's been proven time and again, and there's data to support that the more you decouple that process, the higher the consent rate would be. I think on a case-by-case basis, and it still happens, we still have physicians who will approach the family and have that conversation about, hey, have you ever thought of organ donation? Well, there's someone who'd like to talk to you. That does happen. And, you know, we've had that at Brigham where we've had physicians bring up the subject with the family, and that's actually led to the family refusing to donate, to refusing to consent. So it seems to make sense, and I think maybe on a certain level that discussion from the physician can happen, as long as they know how to have that discussion. But I think overall the recommendation, and if you want to, like, especially as you're telling the residents and fellows, they should not be having that discussion.
Well, that's good to know for being a resident myself. The last question I really have about the organ donation, unless Dr. Martin has another one, is what are your thoughts on donation after cardiac death?
Yeah, you know, so that's something that, you know, Matt was asking about. How are we doing in terms of numbers? You know, as we're sort of going, trying to find ways to increase the numbers of donors. And one way is actually going back to cardiac death, donation after cardiac death. So those numbers have actually been increasing. And if you look at across the country, the goal is to have about 10% of all donors be donors after cardiac death. So it is something that people are pushing more, but you know, it's not very easy. You have to have sort of a confluence of circumstances to make the candidates, you know, sort of the right candidates for that.
So Ali, tell me about your protocol for DCD now at the Brigham, or do you have a protocol? And if you do, you know, what does it call for? How long do you let them go until you are assured they don't have return of spontaneous circulation? Who's declaring them dead? Just the key points.
Yeah, you know, great questions. Yeah, we do have a protocol, which actually they're looking back to try to maybe change. So you have the perfect candidate who's that patient who you can't declare brain dead. They have a devastating injury, a head injury, or maybe a cardiopulmonary failure, so they can't live without the ventilator. Basically, the wishes have been made that they want to be a donor. You kind of look at the patient, look at the physiology, look at vent, et cetera, and you identify that this is a potential candidate. And then what you do is you get the whole team ready. You usually take the patient to the, here at Brigham, we take the patient to the operating room, and you disconnect them from the ventilator. And you assess how they do off the vent. You give them about an hour to continue breathing, and ideally they stop breathing. And then you have cessation of cardiopulmonary function, and then you have to wait 5 minutes before you can declare them, and then you move on to the next step. Now, that 5 minutes is where the sort of gray zone is. Some places may say 3 minutes, some say 2 minutes, but that 5 minutes of cessation is where some of the variation may be. In terms of who declares them, it could be any physician. We usually have the intensivist here who does the declaration.
All right, Ali. And then you've obviously written quite a bit about potential organ donor management protocols and maximizing the number of organs achieved. So this is outside of the consent process. So just for, let's say, a critical care fellow who's going to be managing one of these patients, you know, as they're herniating and progressing to brain death, I know the old LA County protocol had a bunch of things, a big dose of steroids, a T4 drip, et cetera. So what would you say are the key treatments that you should have ready for these patients and the best evidence-based approach we have now?
Yeah, so I think the key is just identifying that this is just a critically injured patient and it's just a badly head-injured patient, and you basically implement routine critical care. I think that's the biggest thing. You know, basically invasive lines, as you would do with any critically ill patient. Fluid resuscitation, again, is any critically ill patient. There's no real standards in terms of where you should be with fluids. But I think what differentiates these critically ill patients versus some other patients is that you have to understand some of the complications that can occur and anticipate them. You also have to understand that when these patients herniate, that's when their physiology really changes, and it changes abruptly, so you want to anticipate that, because it's not uncommon where you are actually treating someone for hypertension, then all of a sudden they bottom out their pressure because they've herniated. So as long as you understand that physiology and anticipate, I think it's important. So generally, you know, if you're taking care of the patient's normal critical care, you're using vasopressors to maintain a certain MAP of 65 or 70, and you don't start using hormone therapy until you identify that the patient is requiring a certain amount of vasopressors, and then you'd start using hormone therapy. And for us, it's using the thyroid and steroid cocktail and a thyroid drip. I think that the biggest thing is just identifying like some of the complications, such as like the pulmonary edema that can occur, the neurogenic pulmonary edema, some like the coagulopathy that can occur. So you want to be aggressive in terms of getting their coagulopathy under control. Watch out for like changes in abrupt changes in sodium. And I think those are the basic things that you want to watch for. But again, it's really just routine critical care, and you don't start adding something like hormone therapy, which there is a fair amount of evidence that supports its use, until patients are requiring a certain amount of vasopressors to maintain their MAPs at a certain level.
And then who should be doing that? You know, should it be one service who owns the patients? Should it just go to, you know, medicine, trauma, surgery, whichever, you know, they happen to be admitted through?
Well, it depends. You know, if the underlying reason for their head injury is traumatic, it should be in the trauma ICU. If it's non-traumatic, and, you know, the medical team can also take care of them as well. Usually once the patients have been declared brain dead and may move on and potentially consenting for donation, that's when the local OPO would actually start taking care of the patients. And they actually have management guidelines to help them with the care as well.
Well, Dr. Saleem, thank you for that great rundown on that interesting research. This leads into our next section, is our tips and tricks section. And Dr. Saleem, you being a trauma surgeon, we always like to take advantage of that. So what we want to discuss today is penetrating anterior abdominal trauma. So I'm just going to give you a case report. A 20-something male is brought into the ER by EMS with a stab wound to the left abdomen. He's stable, stable vitals, is stable otherwise, talking to you. And now, how would you expect your residents to approach this patient?
First thing, obviously, your primary secondary survey, and you know, for any penetrating injury, you want to identify the patients that can go to the operating room versus those patients that don't need to go to the operating room. And really, reasons to go to the operating room would be, you know, peritonitis, hypotension, and something like evisceration, or inability to do exams where you can't really evaluate their abdomen. Those are reasons you would take someone straight to the operating room. And then those who actually don't have an indication to go straight to the operating room, then, you know, you can have a few things that you can do, whether, you know, for us, serial exams versus doing some sort of investigatory imaging such as a CAT scan. I think we kind of go back and forth about what the appropriate step is, whether we should just do serial exams versus adding a CAT scan. So I think it depends what the mood of the team that's on, and that would sort of dictate what they do. Clearly, there's really no great evidence to prove that CAT scan helps, but there's a lot of great evidence to prove that serial exams is very effective in these patients. So probably the best thing to do would be serial exams in those patients that you've identified that don't have an indication to go to the operating room immediately.
So Ali, one of the terms I think that's thrown around a lot and probably very misunderstood is local wound exploration for anterior abdominal stab wounds. Right. So you just comment on what that actually means, and yeah, should we still be using it, or should that, you know, go the way of the dodo?
So I will admit that that's actually used under many trauma centers' algorithms for abdominal stab wounds. I don't use it, and it's never been part of our protocol. And what it is basically taking the wound, the stab wound, and making the stab wound actually even bigger so you can examine whether the knife actually penetrated the fascia. And the idea is that if you can prove that the knife didn't penetrate the fascia, that means that patient would be safe to be discharged. But if that patient does have fascial penetration, then that implies that you have to do something else. In the old days, it used to be DPL, or now people advocate for doing laparoscopy versus just taking them to the operating room. So I think that where it's really helpful is if it doesn't, where you can prove that the wound did not penetrate the fascia. The problem is that doing the local wound exploration isn't always that easy. It's basically doing a mini laparotomy at the bedside, sometimes extending a stab wound and making it a lot bigger. You have to make sure you're sedating the patient. And then, you know, just being able to accurately identify whether it penetrated the fascia isn't always reliable. So I think, you know, again, for me, who I don't do it, I wouldn't recommend it, but there's plenty of trauma surgeons who have very good experience doing it and would actually advocate the use of local wound exploration.
Well, what's the problem with doing, you know, exploring them, doing a laparotomy, if it clearly penetrated the anterior abdominal fascia? So anterior rectus fascia is penetrated. What's the matter with the policy of just exploring all those patients?
The problem is sort of playing the percentages. So if you've penetrated the fascia, you probably have about a 60% chance that there's an injury there. But you also have a 40% chance that there's no injury. So you're basically taking a group of patients, and 40% of them will have an unnecessary procedure or operation. And we know that there's a downside for doing operations on patients in terms of complications over time. So I think that's the problem, is that 40% of patients that are getting something that they wouldn't have had if they had just had something like serial exams. Because serial exams will identify those patients with fascial penetration that actually will have an injury that needs to be addressed.
Okay, so what would you do with this same patient who is severely intoxicated, so not examinable?
So there's two things. You can either wait until they sober up and do continued serial exams, or in those patients, depending on your protocol, it's reasonable to take those patients to the operating room. I mean, there are studies that say that even though they're intoxicated, you can still do an exam on them. So it really is those patients who are more unavailable from, like, say, a head injury or something, where there's no reasonable way you can do an exam. Those are the patients I would take to the operating room. But someone who's intoxicated, you can conceivably wait and have them sober up some and continue serial exams.
Okay, so no role for CT scanning these patients if their exam is compromised?
So I have no problems with scanning. In fact, I've done studies looking at CAT scanning. The problem with scanning is that you would scan them and you would probably still observe them anyway, because there's not much on a CAT scan that would help you determine whether the patient could be discharged or not. You know, sort of that negative a predictive value of the CAT scan.
Okay, and then
that
final
said,
twist.
Yeah, that was, you know, for your left lower quadrant as the patient. But I think, you know, someone who has a right upper quadrant injury, I think a CAT scan would be useful because, you know, it could just be a liver injury that you can identify real quickly with a CAT scan.
Sure. And so final twist on this guy. So the stab wound is in the left upper quadrant, right at the costal margin. Stable, yeah. Benign abdominal exam. Is there anything else that we should be worried about or doing down the line?
Yeah, it's something that we worry just because of the location. You worry about diaphragmatic injury, and those are the patients that would probably warrant laparoscopy to rule out diaphragm injury.
So when would you do that? Would you take them right from the ER? Would you do it in a delayed fashion after serial exams?
I prefer to do it in a delayed fashion after serial exams, only because I'm not as good as some of my colleagues in terms of exploring the abdomen laparoscopically. I think for those who can actually explore the abdomen laparoscopically, you can take the patient immediately, do an exploration. If there's a diaphragm injury, you can repair that. But for me, I would prefer to do serial exams after a finite amount of time, then take them to the operating room for a diagnostic lab.
Okay, and then the real final little twist. So the guy's got a little bit of omentum poking out. But otherwise, yeah. You know, benign exam, not real concerning. So does that, you said evisceration, does that count as evisceration? Does that mandate laparotomy?
Depends on where you are. I think the right answer, and because residents and fellows are listening to this podcast, those patients need to go to the operating room.
Okay, so the patient said Brigham, and you're the surgeon.
At this point, I would take him to the operating room. And even if you look at some of the recent papers at L.A. County, who probably has some of the largest experience of doing this, you know, they kind of include evisceration as their indication for going to the operating room. So when they do their studies on anterior-abdominal stab wounds, they exclude those patients because they take those patients to the operating room. That being said, also Demetriotis has great experience and has really written about evisceration and not operating on them as well. But in this day, and with my residents, and since they're residents and fellows who are listening on the podcast, I would say going to the operating room is the right thing to do.
Okay, great. Well, and I think John has another penetrating abdominal patient for you arriving in the trauma bay. Is that right, John?
I do, yeah. This is the more simpler one with a large gunshot wound to the anterior abdomen. And obviously, I think that's one of all the residents are hoping for, and we can finally get to the operating room instead of doing serial exams on the floor. But I guess, is there any other, you know, things we should think about when we have a gunshot wound? Is there any patient you don't want to take to the operating room?
I think we talk about non-operative management of abdominal gunshot wounds, and it really depends on where you are. So, but if you were going to do non-operative management, it's sort of the same criteria. You have your indications for surgery: peritonitis, instability, lack of ability to do exams, etc. And if you identify a percentage of patients that don't meet those criteria, and you want to do non-operative management, the first thing you would do is do a CAT scan. Because whereas the CAT scan for stab wounds, we're not really sure how helpful that is and where that role is. For gunshot wounds, it's pretty much been established that it's really helpful in identifying the trajectory of the bullet. So those patients who are stable with no peritonitis and are evaluable, you can get a CAT scan. You look at the trajectory of the bullet. And if it looks like it's something that's going into something that's causing an injury, you would take them to the operating room. If it looks like it's something away, you can see the path completely, and you can see that it's away from the peritoneum, away from any vital structures, you can conceivably send those patients home. And then there's those patients who you're not really quite sure of the trajectory. You would observe those patients and do serial exams on those patients.
How long is a good time to observe these patients before you feel comfortable sending them home? Is it just until they feel...
I think we accept 24 hours. I know there's some studies that say even sooner than that, but we are comfortable at 24 hours.
All right.
Okay, so Ali, so this guy has a gunshot wound in the left upper quadrant, single wound, and he does have peritonitis and tachycardic. Yep. Tell me what's the rest of your workup going to be? Are you going to do anything, any more imaging? You're going to bring him right to the OR? What would you do with this guy?
Yeah, so clearly the patient needs to go to the operating room, and you're just trying to think about any intervention that you would do that would be helpful. And I think just an X-ray, a chest X-ray, would be helpful just because you don't really know what the trajectory of the bullet is. So you want to get a sense of whether the bullet actually could have gone into the chest, etc. So getting a chest X-ray would be very helpful. And the only other thing you really need is a type and cross and go straight to the operating room.
Okay, so what about the role for a fast exam?
No, I think, you know, a patient who's got peritonitis, a fast exam isn't going to change your management at all.
What about the pericardial
prevention of the fast? Actually, really probably the only time that a fast would be helpful would be just to rule out a pericardial effusion.
Okay, so let's say you have this guy and you do your pericardial view and it's questionable. You know, you think there's probably a little fluid there, and you take him to the OR for a laparotomy.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there's two things that you can do, and it all depends on your who you're working with in terms of anesthesiologist. So the way I would handle that would be basically, since you're doing a laparotomy for the peritonitis, you can quickly assess the pericardium by doing a transdiaphragmatic pericardial window. That way, you can kind of see where the heart is pulsating. You grab the diaphragm right there, incise it, and you can get access to the pericardium, and you can tell right away whether it's positive or negative. The other approach, you know, if you have a great anesthesiologist who can do an intra-op echo as you're doing the laparotomy, that's something to consider as well.
Real quickly, what are a couple of some of the biggest mistakes you've seen made with penetrating abdominal trauma?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was thinking the same thing.
I think the biggest probably mistakes, number one, you know, with the thoracoabdominal injury, going into the wrong cavity in an unstable patient, whereas you think that maybe they're sick from the abdomen when they're really sick from a chest injury, so you're doing the laparotomy and they're still bleeding from the chest, so opening the wrong cavity. There's always the missed injury, where is, you know, you'll have multiple injuries to bowel and you don't account for all the holes and you may miss an injury. I think also, you know, exploring big hematomas without communicating with your anesthesiologist before they're actually ready or can handle massive blood loss. I think that's a mistake. And I think those are probably the more common and biggest mistakes that you can make.
Now, how about there's a lot of people who question the selective non-operative management for abdominal gunshot wounds, you know, yeah, who say you are gonna miss somebody, you know, who's got a significant injury, who doesn't look sick up front, and that's right, gonna lead to something bad down the line. So have you seen that happen personally, or do you think that's a valid concern, or is physical exam, you know, 100%?
I think that's a very valid concern, and I think that's why I think you have to be very selective on where you can actually do selective non-operative management. I mean, I think where places like a USC who've written the most about it, they've actually had a step-down area that was specifically for patients who they can actually do serial exams. Not many places have that. Typically, if you have someone with a stab wound or a gunshot wound, they would get admitted on the floor, and there's really no one who can go up to the floor and do serial exams. So those kind of places should not have selective non-operative management. And those proponents, those people who advocate selective non-operative management, will say is that because the injuries that are identified, even in a delayed fashion, it doesn't increase their morbidity on these patients. So that's why it's safe in terms of certain places. If you have the right circumstances, I think it is a safe option to do.
Okay, well, Dr. Saleem, I appreciate that great rundown. I can't think of a better way to really dive into penetrating abdominal trauma other than having two great trauma surgeons work at it and work through it all. And, you know, this leads us to our next section of our podcast, is the final five. Dr. Martin has done this probably a couple times now or something similar to it. This is where we ask you a few questions to really let the listeners know, our guests, and just get them to know how they are, maybe outside the operating room as well. The first question I have for you is, what's on your iPod, or what music are you playing in the operating room when you're in there? Or is it the resident who's dictating everything?
Unfortunately, at Brigham, we're the ones dictating everything. So music in the operating room, great question. When I'm working out, I tend to listen to podcasts. Now, I'm going to absolutely start subscribing to your podcast. So I'll make sure that's on my playlist. Oh, yeah. But I mostly listen to podcasts when I'm working out. In terms of music, yeah, I've gotten a little old. I'm very mellow, sort of just slow R&B, some jazz.
I was hoping you weren't going to say Katy Perry like Dr. Steele. He's always a Katy Perry fan. So.
No. But plus, you know, you have to... I have two girls, and a lot of music on my playlist is definitely like Disney Channel music, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think Ali has Let It Go from Frozen on a continuous loop.
On a continuous loop, absolutely.
That's good.
It's my favorite go-to video as well.
Outside of the OR and outside of medicine, any particular hobbies, talents, or interests that we don't know about?
No, you know, just spending time with the family now. As you know, I have a 9-month-old now, so a lot of our time is spent corralling our three kids at the house and actually trying to support my wife, since I'm always away, and trying to act like I can actually do something in the house. So I spend a lot of time there. I do like running. I still enjoy running outside. Dr. Martin and myself used to run together quite a bit until he got old and claims he can't run anymore. But that's something I still like to do in the spring and summer here in Boston, because I still haven't been able to get myself out when it gets cold here in Boston to run.
I heard you used to run through some interesting parts of L.A., is that right?
That's right. We used to run, have our, what we'd call our ghetto run, which is right around L.A. County. It was a lot of fun.
All right, third question. What is a favorite trip or vacation that you've taken recently?
So we've been going to Hawaii as a family every year, and that still continues to be our favorite trip. Yeah, just getting away somewhere that's sun, a lot of beach, a lot of water. As you can see, I'm not into the cold, and it's something that the family really enjoys. So we were just in Hawaii last year.
Oh, good.
Big Island. Had a wonderful time.
And on that same line, how about trips back to Tanzania, Ali?
Yeah, I haven't been back in 2 years now. I had actually, the last time I went back was right before I started the job here. But we're planning on going back this summer, going to take the family there and introduce my son to Tanzania for the first time. So we are all looking forward to that.
But as speaking as someone who's never been, so for someone who's never been, is that a place to go and see?
Absolutely. It's got everything that you'd want to see when you're visiting a place in Africa. We have the best national reserves, the game parks, if you want to go see wildlife. We have Mount Kilimanjaro if you want to go climb a ridiculously tall mountain. We have some of the best beaches in the world in Zanzibar and off the coast of Tanzania. And probably the nicest people that you'd meet in Africa, all in Tanzania. So definitely highly recommend that you make that trip.
All right, well, I'm still waiting for my invitation from you, so maybe someday.
You're always invited, man.
We'll move on to the next question. So if you couldn't do surgery, or even you couldn't do medicine, what would be your next job choice?
I think I'd probably be a teacher. Besides being an investment banker, something that I would enjoy would be teaching. Yeah, I've thought of that before. What else that kind of gives you the joy that we do right now? And a lot of that would be still teaching. Not sure what grade, but be involved in some sort of education environment.
Sure. Well, that'd be pretty similar to what you
young,
do.
Young, smart
people. Blood.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah.
All right, fifth question. If you can go back in time and see yourself on the first day of your internship, what advice would you give yourself?
Wow. Besides saying don't do it, what would I say? When you meet this guy at Dr. Martin, stay away from him. That's one. No, I think I'd just stay with it and, you know, just kind of even when you're discouraged and unhappy that you can get through it and that it only gets better.
All right. Well, Dr. Saleem, we can't thank you enough for coming on our podcast today. It's your first visit here, and Dr. Martin, this is probably your third or fourth now. It's been a great talk. The Penetrating Abdominal Talk is definitely something that everyone's going to enjoy a lot. So Dr. Saleem, Dr. Martin, thank you again for joining us on Behind the Knife.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Yep, thanks, John. Thanks, Ali. That was great.
just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindthenife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fash is closed and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.